Dermatology is a specialty that blends the best of medicine and surgery, and we continue to witness the ever-evolving surgical innovations of our discipline. Our emphasis on safety has naturally extended to the field of dermatologic surgery. In our next dialogue, Dr. Joseph Sabenko and Dr. Gary Bronner discuss surgical and procedural safety.
Today you'll be hearing from Dr. Joseph Sabenko, who's assistant professor of dermatology at the University of Pennsylvania, and director of dermatologic surgical education there as well. And we're going to be going over procedural safety, another how-to type talk that really concerns the environment of the office and how to keep our offices more efficient and safer for us as well. I'm going to do a little editorializing first, and then as I frame the questions for you on this particular issue, because it's been something that's been critically important to me as well, and when I lecture as well, and when I teach my term surgery fellows and residents as well. And I basically tell people that I'm ruled by the first rule of medicine, which is first do no harm to your patient, primum non nocere. Obviously, in a scenario like this, we don't want to burn our offices down. That's good procedural safety. We don't want to hurt our staff. And also, what I point out is we also don't want to injure the next patient following the patient that we're treating. We have to think of what is left in the scene when the next patient walks into the room. So I'm going to focus on those points, those four areas, at least in the questioning today, so that we can deal with that. And hopefully our listeners' questions will be answered as well when we try to cover all four of those aspects: the patient, ourselves, the staff, and the next patient coming into the room. So let's go over the patient and patient safety. Are there federal rules or state laws or workman's comp laws that force us to behave in a particular way in the office to provide safety to ourselves and to our staff?
Well, there are a number of regulations out there. I would say probably the most important are the ones that were enacted in the late 90s and early 2000s, where we implemented standard precautions, in addition to the Needle Safety and Prevention Act, where interactions with patients where there was potential for having either blood or mucocutaneous splashes, the implementation of gloves and other barriers in order to protect not only the healthcare worker, but the patients themselves were implemented.
So there are OSHA, that was presumably the OSHA regulations. If our listeners wanted to access that kind of information, they certainly can get OSHA information from the Academy, where they've got booklets. Are there any other sources that you would have them search for?
Correct.
In terms of trying to see that they're compliant with the law, because at least with OSHA, the penalties can be gigantic.
I would encourage them. The Department of Labor website has information. In addition, you can link OSHA from that website. There they have the Bloodborne Pathogen Standard online, and that can be accessed through the website.
The Academy publishes things to be helpful as well. I would encourage them also to see if they can Google or find out from their local state medical society whether that their particular state has some idiosyncratic rules, workman's comp rules or whatever, that also have to do with the work environment that they don't want to miss and get penalized for also in the environment that occurs for dermatologists and physicians in general now. Let's talk then about safety. What are the kind of scenarios in which patient injury occurs and we should be trying to avoid?
Well, I think that if we look at the data that's been published from other specialties, it's been shown that postoperative complications can be reduced by half just with the implementation of a surgical checklist. Now, this is something that I don't believe is adopted from our specialty across the board, and it's something that many of us should think about. Now, if you look at the CDC, WHO strategy, they took many sites throughout the world, I believe 8 in total, and implemented a simple checklist of 18 items and studied the postoperative complications over the course of an entire year. Complications decreased by 50%. Now, if you apply that checklist to a dermatologic practice, it's onerous and certainly not applicable. Much of it has to deal with preoperative anesthesia and other things that we may not be dealing with. I've sat on the office-based workgroup surgery task force, and what we've tried to do is implement something that's not onerous and sort of applicable to the practicing dermatologist and dermatologic surgeon, where you've got a simple checklist that can be done prior to any procedure, whether it be a biopsy or more complex surgical reconstruction, that's applicable, identifies patient name, identifies if they have any allergies, and implementing that is something that hopefully we as a group can agree that is safe for patients and will improve patient outcome and sort of fits in line with something that I'd like to promote in terms of a culture of safety.
Is that something that's accessible through the Academy or through a publication that you've written?
This is something that Dr. Hanke will be presenting to the Academy, and the goal is within the next year or two to have an entire booklet that can be distributed to anyone who's performing office-based surgery.
In the meantime, while we're waiting for that to come from the Academy, hopefully this tape will be released before then, and you can go through some of the things on the checklist and tell us what's important. So what's important?
Well, I think what's important is each practice is different, and to sort of tether one to every practice may not be applicable. What I'd encourage is effective communication. So right off the bat, effectively communicating to the patient, making sure that if you're performing a simple shave or punch biopsy, prior to that procedure, identifying that the patient is the correct patient, identifying whether or not they've been properly anesthetized, identifying whether or not they have any allergies, and then likewise during the procedure, ensuring that the specimen that has been taken, there's a checkbox that the specimen has adequately been placed into the container, that the container has been labeled. And then postoperatively, a checklist such as ensuring that the patient has received postoperative wound care instructions. And simple strategies like that are not onerous, and I think everyone would agree, particularly patients, that they can be reassured that every step of the way, the proper tasks have been performed to ensure that everything is done properly and safely.
Let's get a little bit more specific about some of the questions, too, that you ask them. You've identified the patient. You've identified the site, the checklist, the site. Do you identify... This may sound silly, but it's one of the things that I always highlight in teaching my residents as well, is handing the patient a mirror to make sure that, if particularly it's an elective procedure, that you, in fact, are treating the proper lesion that the patient's concerned about. Because as an aside, I had a patient come in when I was first in practice who said, I want this mole taken off. It's not patient safety. And I took the mole off. Patient goes to the bathroom. I've shaved it off. Goes to the bathroom, comes out, I hear a scream from the bathroom, she comes out, she says, oh, that great big mole, I love that mole, I wanted you to take this little teeny one off here. So it's kind of, we're pointing, making sure that you've got exactly the right site. Anyway, it's inside.
I couldn't agree more regarding the patient identification. My practice is heavily Mohs and reconstructive based, and I will not perform a procedure unless I have two of three things. One, a preoperative photo that was either taken by my office if I've done the biopsy, or another office, or if there have been coordinates taken, and or if the patient can identify the site in a mirror. If two of those three things can happen, then I feel confidently to move forward.
You don't want to be removing not the knot lesion, and which can happen in Mohs surgery when you've got a long delay between your initial consultation and the actual surgery as well. Are there any particular scenarios that you, again, are encouraging the physician to avoid in terms of needle injury?
This is probably the biggest thing I'm pushing for in terms of the culture of safety. If we look at the data, not just within our specialty, but across the board, there are close to a million needle sticks that occur in the United States each year. And when you tally it, one out of five healthcare workers will be injured every year through a needle stick. If you look at data that's been published on urban settings in hospitalized patients, anywhere between a quarter and more than a third of patients will have a bloodborne pathogen, whether it be HIV, hepatitis B, hepatitis C. If you look at the patients who have hepatitis, particularly C, 2% of the country has hepatitis C, and only 20% of those patients are symptomatic. So I encourage those that I train and those that I work with to approach every patient as if standard precautions absolutely must be implemented, because you don't know if the patient has it, whether or not they provide the history of a bloodborne pathogen. In addition to that, there are many strategies that you can implement that are inexpensive that can reduce the risk of needle sticks. Something that has been implemented in the past decade are safer sharps, so disposable needles, disposable scalpels that have a safety engagement device that ensures that once the instrument is done, it's locked, cannot be used again, and can be disposed of. We all should have sharps containers in our offices, but one thing that's been demonstrated through many studies is that if sharps containers are not placed in the proper location in the room, people start to seek other easier ways to dispose of the sharps. So in addition to having sharps containers, they should be properly placed in the right area so they can be easily disposed of. If you look at the timing of needle sticks, the majority of needle sticks occur during this procedure or immediately after the procedure, but prior to disposal. And so I would say that during a procedure, many of the sharps injuries that occur are due to transferring of sharps from one, whether it be the surgeon to the assistant or vice versa. And so a simple strategy that doesn't cost any money is ensuring that sharps are not transferred from hand to hand. When a procedure is being performed, if a surgical tray can be placed between the surgeon and the assistant, that tray then acts as a neutral zone, and the sharp can be placed down on the tray and then can be picked up by the other person. So these are simple strategies that don't cost much money. It's been shown through education of workers and trainees that the more that this culture of safety is taught, implemented, and more that employees understand how these safe practices work, the safer the environment. So one thing that should be emphasized is that once a sharp is in an area, it is live. So setting up a tray can introduce risk. Disposing of sharps can introduce a risk. 15% of sharps injuries occur once the sharp is being disposed of. So at any point, there's a needle, a scalpel, a sharp on the area. It should be emphasized that safe practices need to be implemented.
Do you recommend that the staff always remove the sharps, or that the surgeon remove the sharps so that the staff doesn't have to be concerned about them sticking themselves?
That's an absolutely great question. And it's not my position to say what each practice should do, but the one thing that I will encourage, and I think many of us will agree on, is that consistency is very important. So if practice decides that the assistant will dispose of the sharps, that should be done every time so that there's no question as to whether it's been done. If the practice decides that the surgeon will dispose of the sharps, that should be done every time. But above all else, it should be also reinforced that a safe surgical tray is one that is kept relatively neat. So whether it be the surgeon or the assistant, reaching for sharps underneath gauze and other things that have created a messy tray, that can introduce a risk. So throughout the procedure, bloody gauze should be disposed of rather than accumulate on a tray. Sutures should be protected, whether it be in a sponge gauze or a suture counter. There are many different ways, and each practice should definitely decide what's best for them, but certainly think through each of the steps of a procedure and identify where there's an area where there's a potential for risk for injury and implement something safer.
Do you recommend the removal of materials from the tray by instrument rather than by finger so that you don't pick up a needle that's wrapped in a gauze?
Absolutely. If you can ensure that all of the sutures are kept in a sponge or in a suture counter, I would say that reaching on a tray would be safe. But that said, you know, if you've got a hemostat to sort of fish through the tray, that certainly does eliminate the potential risk of having a digital injury.
Any other suggestions that you have too?
This is something that I'm collaborating on with Jacob Levin out of Mount Sinai. We're actually going to publish an atlas on safe procedures where we look at all of the most commonly performed surgical procedures within dermatology, identifying ways in which we may be practicing that are not safe and trying to implement strategies that are safer and relatively inexpensive. So just the example that you'd given, reaching on the tray could potentially introduce a risk of a sharp stick to the finger. Likewise, when you're blotting in the field, if the assistant is blotting with gauze and there's a sharp in the area, that introduces an area of risk. So encouraging your assistant to blot with gauze that's on a hemostat, or just ensuring that there's proper communication without the procedure so that there's a proactive approach and the assistant can anticipate what the surgeon will be doing. These are many ways that are inexpensive and can promote this culture of safety.
In terms of office environment, are there other types of procedures, including laser procedures, that one has to deal with the environment itself to try to protect your staff and yourself and the patient from injury?
Absolutely. So whether it be laser procedures, cosmetic procedures, there are many safe strategies that you can implement. With lasers, it needs to be ensured that the room is mirrorless, or if there is a mirror in the room, that it's covered, that the laser is not taken out of its safety holster unless everyone in the room has goggles on. Anything that can reflect that laser light should be covered, whether it be watches or jewelry. Strategies that, you know, even ensuring that when staff members wipe off a patient's skin that's to be laced, ensuring that it's done with wet gauze from water rather than alcohol so that the laser light doesn't create a flame. So these are strategies that are inexpensive and are safe.
And you also need fire protection too. Most institutions even don't realize. You need to have a fire extinguisher by the door in case there is a fire. And in terms of eye protection, of course, that's the critical thing, making sure the patient's eyes are properly protected, and making sure, at least in my experience with laser surgery, which is, I think, the most common error of all, particularly since people may have multiple lasers, is to always read the side of the goggle that you're about to put on your head to make sure it's the right goggle for the right laser, since laser goggles get moved from room to room accidentally. I think that's a critical issue. at least in terms of patient safety and environmental safety. Any other tricks to not burn our offices down or explode our offices, which is part of safety? I mean, you want to keep a safe environment. We don't generally have oxygen in our offices that may explode, but are there any other things one has to be concerned about other than, say, the alcohol issue?
Speaking of incendiary events, I would say that those that practice on patients that are relatively ill that come in with oxygen containers, ensuring that the electrosurgical device that's being used, whether it be for a biopsy or for a larger surgical procedure, that oxygen tank be off when that electrosurgical device is in use.
And what about things like pacemakers and electrical disruption?
That's a fantastic question. And this is a, I wouldn't say hotly debated issue, but I would say it's something that for my trainees is one of the more complex issues, because there have in the past decade probably been about 5 excellent papers published from various sources as to what the safest strategy would be. And what I can say across the board, things that are known to be true, is that if a patient has an electrical implantable device, whether it be a defibrillator or a neuron stimulator, cochlear device, is that the absolute safest way to obtain hemostasis is with thermal electrocautery. Now, that's the right answer. The issue becomes practicality. How well does that device work, particularly for larger surgical procedures and in patients who are likely already on anticoagulants? I would say that they are not very effective in my experience. So what I encourage those that I work with is, if there's a question at all as to the device, there's no harm in contacting the device manufacturer and or the physician who implanted that device as to determine what the safest technique is. There are some defibrillators and pacemakers that the manufacturer and the physician that implanted the device will actually prefer it actually be turned off with a magnet. One thing I will say is that if the device is not turned off with a magnet, what is important is to ensure that if there's a bi-terminal system that occurs, that the grounding pad is not placed in a way in which that electrosurgical device is between the hand tip and the grounding pad. The area of where you're gaining hemostasis should be beyond 15 centimeters of the electrosurgical device. And equally as important is, with those bursts of electrosurgical energy, ensuring that they're short bursts. So depending upon who you read, some say it should be shorter than 2 seconds, others say it should be shorter than 5 seconds. But each of these modalities will ensure that it's safe. Now, there are reports that there has been interference with devices in the outpatient setting in dermatologic surgery. They're few and far between. That's often, and you'll read in literature, that's outside our specialty. But it is important to recognize, to take that history that a patient has it, and to attempt every step of the way a safe safety mechanism in place to ensure that there's no interference.
Again, this is an issue that I often find myself in error or trying to double check myself, because with all of the implantable devices and joints and everything that our bionic patients are coming in with now, I tend to forget. I mean, I look for the cigarette pack on their chest to see if they've got a pacemaker. But in terms of, I have to force myself to ask, do they have any other electronic devices in their body, which you don't see as a cigarette pack, that you're not going to be able to detect before I go do any electrical bifurcation on that particular patient. So it gets to be a challenge trying to figure out whether they've got something or not, and hoping that the only thing that they remember that they had something done that has left them with an electronic device in their body. Let's talk a little bit about the next patient, because it's always been a favorite subject of mine, because people tend to forget that. They know about needle sticks, and they know about what's happening right in front of them, and then walk out of the room, and the next patient goes into the room. When the next patient goes into the room, they're walking into a room where there's been vapor from a carbon dioxide laser that's still floating around that you can breathe and smell, that may not have been sucked up properly. And they're exposed to that, as well as your staff and yourself. They walk into the room and they open the door, touching the handle that's just been liberally wiped with blood from a glove from a staff member who thinks they're protected, but has wiped blood all over the entire room with the bloody glove. What kinds of things should one do to try to protect that next patient that walks into the room? You don't think about them.
Correct. And this all fits in line with the culture of safety, so that every step of a procedure that's being performed is safe. And safety needs occur not just during the procedure, but with the disposal of sharps and other items. So, for example, oftentimes we may see either a coworker or a trainee dispose of their gloves in a way where they're shooting it like a basketball or flicking it off. And that alone may or may not get the glove into the receptacle, but it can splatter blood in other places, and that if it doesn't go into the receptacle, needs to be picked up. So it introduces sort of a lot of areas where it needs to be additionally cleaned up. So disposing of things properly immediately after procedure. Another example with gloves is ensuring you're not touching surfaces with a bloody glove. The gloves should be used only in the surgical field, so that if you're going to then reach for gauze to then use during the procedure, those gloves need to be taken off, gauze needs to be picked up on the countertop, placed down, and then re-gloved so that you're not transferring blood and other fluids to areas that are considered clean. Gloves should not be used to open the door to walk outside. Gloves should never be in the hallway of a practice. They should be disposed of immediately prior to leaving the room. And surfaces need to be washed down, so the chair that the patient was in, any countertop that was used, should be effectively washed. And this is something that education of the trainees and the coworkers, the employees that you have, it needs to just be emphasized that this is extraordinarily important, not just for the current patient, but as you mentioned, for the patient that is about to walk into the room.
Let's talk a little bit about mistakes that happen to the physician and the staff. Suppose the staff does get injured. Suppose the physician does get injured because certain precautions weren't being taken. Then what do we do next? What happens if a staff member gets a needle stick?
It's important to recognize that whether you practice in an academic setting or a private office, that if there is injury, the most important thing for that person who's received a needle stick, they need to stop and step away from the field, or if they're disposing of the sharp, stop, and then need to assess what's happened, okay? There are many instances where people just don't report their injuries. They opt to either say that the day is too busy and would prefer not to report it, or certain instances, some will not report simply because they feel like it will reflect negatively upon them. I think the average number that many of the reports state is that up to 3/4 of needle sticks are not reported. So if we know that there's 800,000 to 1 million needle sticks a year, that number may actually be severely underreported. So whoever receives that injury needs to step away, and wherever that injury has occurred needs to be washed for at least 5 minutes under water with soap. You don't need to apply bleach or alcohol. Applying pressure or milking the area has not been shown to reduce any transference of a bloodborne pathogen. But there should be a system in place within the institution or within the practice that then that patient that the injury had occurred from can be tested. So if it is occurring during a procedure, it's helpful to know that that is that patient, and that patient may then be consented to test for any bloodborne pathogens if their status is already not known. The employee should then also be tested, and then depending upon what that source patient's test shows, will then dictate as to what the next steps will be. So if the patient is not HIV positive and is low risk, any post-exposure prophylaxis may actually not be recommended. This is based on the CDC recommendations. If the patient is known to have HIV, then there needs to be a discussion with occupational health as to whether or not post-exposure prophylaxis is worthwhile. It's known that if the patient is HIV positive and has a high viral load, that's considered a high-risk stick and may actually warrant not just 2-drug, but 3-drug post-exposure prophylaxis. There's a tricky situation where if an employee receives a stick and that source patient is not known, and so there's not a source patient to test whether or not they have a bloodborne pathogen, and that's where having a system in place with occupational health to then counsel the patient as to whether or not post-exposure prophylaxis is worthwhile. It's important to recognize that not all sticks are equal. A low-risk stick is something that is grazing the skin with a sharp needle rather than a hollow bore needle. There are high-risk sticks where an instrument has recently been pulled out of an artery or a vein and then deeply penetrates through the employee's skin. The risk of receiving a bloodborne pathogen that way is much higher than with a low-risk stick, and all of these factors are taken into place. It should be emphasized that a needle stick is something that can implement post-traumatic stress disorder. It's very, very traumatic to the person to which it occurs. And since they're so common, it's really important to just, in this culture of safety, emphasize that no one's at fault and that support should be provided for that person who's received the exposure. The single most important identifier for that person who's been injured to report the injury is someone else seeing it. So if you see one of your workers receive an injury, again, it's not, we have a busy day, don't worry about it. It should more along the lines be, please step away from the field, we'll make this okay. And having a plan already in place so that all the coworkers know that if a stick does occur, what the next steps will be.
Dr. Spanko, I want to thank you very much for this wonderful and thorough interview and hope it keeps us and our patients safer.
Dr. Bronner, thanks so much. It's an honor to be able to speak to you. And thank you very much.
Ensuring patient and physician safety during dermatologic surgical procedures is our prime directive. Prior hospital-based research has shown the effectiveness of implementing surgical checklists for reducing surgical complications, a strategy now widely adopted across inpatient facilities. While not directly applicable in the ambulatory setting due to the additional complexities of surgeries occurring under general anesthesia, as Dr. Sabanko noted, the conceptual motivation of a checklist remains highly relevant in surgical dermatology to ensure consistency of care delivery. The American Academy of Dermatology is preparing a procedural safety booklet for its members, which should be available for distribution in the next year. And in the meantime, dermatologists can take steps to standardize their surgical and procedural processes to include key elements of correct patient identification, site and type of procedure, and assessment of allergies, as well as, when applicable, labeling of biopsy containers, capture of biopsy specimens, and provision of postoperative wound care instructions. A culture of patient safety also enhances physician safety, particularly given the real risk to the doctor of infectious disease transmission through needle sticks and other percutaneous injuries. Dr. Sabanko describes improved safety through use of disposable sharps when possible, elimination of hand-to-hand transfer of surgical instruments, and availability as well as proper placement of sharps containers in patient rooms. Additional strategies to increase safety include keeping surgical trays free of clutter and organized, protecting sutures in sponge gauze or suture counters, and using hemostats with gauze to clear blood from surgical fields. Of course, safety applies to other surgical procedures in dermatology. Laser-based interventions should not be used in rooms with mirrors. Reflective surfaces, including jewelry or watches, should be removed or fully covered. Protective goggles that block the correct wavelength of light should be worn by everyone in the room prior to the removal of the laser from its safety holster. Wetted gauze with water should be used to clean skin prior to lasing, not alcohol, to minimize the risk of fire. Given recent research indicating ongoing practice gaps in fostering a culture of safety among dermatology trainees and other members of their healthcare teams, promoting safety continues to be highly relevant for our specialty and the patients we serve. Our guiding principles should remain primum non nocere, first do no harm, and the rest will follow.